the week of September 16th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 424, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
Hi, Michael. How are you?
Oh, I'm great, Sperling. I forgot to ask you before the show, will there be a show next week?
Well, it's funny you should say that because I noticed that you hadn't forgotten, or sorry, you had forgotten to ask me before we started recording. And I thought, I'm going to have to explain that I will be traveling next week and the week after. However,
oh my God,
we can possibly record on Sunday rather than on Monday. And if we record on Sunday during the day, there can be a show next week.
Well, I'm always available, so we'll make next week happen, but 2 weeks from now, we may miss us.
Correct. So we'll just make all this right. One extra long, so it just takes you longer to listen to.
I have faith in us. We can do that. So yes. What are we going to talk about?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we waited a day to record so we could watch the Emmy Awards, unlike everybody else, and make a list of all the shows we really should be watching but haven't gotten around to yet. To help us discuss the winners and the broadcast and what it all means, we'll be joined by awards expert Ann Thompson, editor-at-large of IndieWire. Speaking of awards, Ann just got back from the Toronto International Film Festival and from Telluride, so she'll be able to brief us on the fall festival season and the start of the next awards season. In China news, we may be seeing an end to those subsidized movie tickets that have fueled a war between online ticket sellers looking to gain market share. The government is reportedly cracking down starting October 1st. In book filter news, we're wondering why the work of the hugely popular Spanish writer Carlos Ruiz Zafón hasn't been adopted into a movie, or adapted, I should say, into a movie or television series yet. In sexual misconduct news, Jeff Fager is out at 60 Minutes, producer John Peters is messing with the Oscar mojo of A Star Is Born, Norm MacDonald puts his foot in his mouth, not once, but twice, and Linda Bloodworth Thomason savors the schadenfreude of Les Moonves' Fall from Grace. On Inside Baseball, we untangle the game-changing but confusing rules on copyright the European Union is putting into place. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, The New York Times, you, our listeners. And the number one movie around the world, it's the sixth in a franchise, it would be The Predator. $55 million on its opening weekend. It is the sixth film in the franchise. It costs $90 million to make, which doesn't make sense to me since the top grosser in the entire franchise is Alien versus Predator, and that only made $170 million. So they're really making it tough on themselves. This movie needs to make a lot more than the highest grossing Predator film just to break even at the box office.
When was Alien versus Predator, though?
It's not that long ago, 10 years, but you know, it's not enough to make that big a difference.
Yeah, 2004, so you know, we're talking 14 years. Yeah.
It's not decades.
Yeah.
But anyway, they've set the bar high. They've invested a lot of money, and it got off to a decent opening weekend of $54 million. Kind of weak here in North America, but we'll have to see where it ends up. At number two around the world is another scary movie. It's The Nun. $51 million on the weekend, $228 million worldwide. Also part of a big franchise, as is number three. This is a Chinese-Hong Kong film. It's called L Storm. And it proves I just don't understand China. It's a thriller starring Louis Koo about police battling corruption. It's the third in a series. I'm going to guess it maybe cost $10 million to make. But the first film in the franchise was called Z Storm. And the second film in the franchise was called S Storm. Now the third film is called L Storm. I mean, what's going on here? Why isn't it not in the other direction? Or maybe the next one will be D Storm. That's all I can guess. But it made $35 million on its opening weekend. And number four is a pretty well-reviewed film. It's called A Simple Favor, starring Anna Kendrick and Blake Lively as a blogger who's trying to figure out where her mysterious rich best friend disappeared. It made $19 million on its opening weekend, and it cost about $19 million, and it's by Paul Feig, who obviously has a really good track record, and this is sort of an offbeat film for him. So cool to see him branching out in a new direction.
And I can tell you, I've seen this film, and it's really fun, and it's not really a blogger. She's a stay-at-home mom who does like a mommy blog, you know, like...
blogging.
Yeah, and she kind of just does that on the side, and a new mother comes along, and she befriends the new, rich, wealthy, cocktail-swilling mother, and then all of a sudden, the mother goes missing, and she's taking care of both, you know, her son and the missing mother's son, and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, you know, I don't make any money on blogging either, so that's blogger doesn't mean it's your career. It just means it's something you do for fun. And of course, Paul, how do you say his name? Feig?
Paul Feig.
Feig. Okay. Of course, he created Freaks and Geeks, which is slowly moving up my chart as one of the greatest TV shows of all time. It might be my favorite drama. I might have to move that into the top spot because watching it again really shows how great it is.
Wow. Are you like literally at the fire station right now?
There's been fire alarms constantly. Maybe my building's on fire. I don't know. I should probably check on that. It's raining. There's tons of thunder and fire alarms constantly. So I don't know what's going on, but there's some fire in New York.
Well, you know,
Bronx is burning.
Let's finish the podcast first. Talk to Anne, and then, you know, you should go figure out whether your building's on fire.
Good idea. At number five around the world is Mission Impossible Fallout. Another $18 million on the weekend, $760 million worldwide. At number six, the first in a franchise, Crazy Rich Asians. There will be three films, I'm sure of it. $16 million on the weekend, $190 million worldwide. They famously, of course, turned down Netflix. Netflix said, we want your movie, and they went with Warner Brothers. They wanted to have that pop cultural impact of a film with an all-Asian cast from America being released in movie theaters. And that gamble paid off because the film could have been a success, could have made money, could have had an impact, but I am convinced the impact it had was much bigger by playing in theaters. At number seven is The Meg, $10 million on the weekend. That has now passed the $500 million mark. And number eight is a small film, Searching, starring John Cho. That made $9 million on the weekend. It's at $45 million worldwide. That movie is doing really, really well. I mean, it only cost $5 million to make. It's made $20 million in North America alone. It's made more money overseas. So this small little film is really paying off for everybody involved. It's from Sony Pictures Classics, I think.
Yes, and it's kind of...
Or just Sony.
Yeah, it started some talk about whether there will be kind of a trend. You know, first it was found footage movies, right? You know, the found footage horror movies. Then it was, you know, low-budget horror movies like...
That's not a trend. That's just a mainstay of cinema.
Right. And now the question is, will there be a screen capture trend where these, you know, low budget screen capture movies where, the you know, everything is on the computer and it's just the computer screen that we're watching? Will that be a trend? I don't know about that.
No, yeah. It won't. Because if anybody thinks that's a thing that needs to be done and again, they're crazy. And number nine is White Boy Rick. $9 million on the weekend, opening to mixed reviews and pretty weak box office. This is a Matthew McConaughey film based on a true story about a kid who becomes a drug dealer and then an informant for the police. They thought they would be an Oscar hopeful, but that certainly is not going to happen.
Wait a second. Who turned my life into a movie?
I didn't know you dealt drugs. And number 10 is Peppermint, the Jennifer Garner revenge flick. $8 million on the weekend, $28 million worldwide. Scrolling down looking for some new films, we've got at number 16, Monstrum. This is a Korean supernatural period film. It's set in the 1500s. Plague is spreading throughout the land, and they are chasing down a mysterious creature. That made $4 million on its opening weekend. And right below that is, I think this is a Japanese film that opened up in China. It's Destiny, Kamakura Story. This is a light mystery fantasy series from Japan. It's about a novelist who deals with small gods and crime on the side. So he's a mystery writer. He sees, you know, supernatural creatures, gods, you know, deities, and he also solves crime. That made $3.8 million on the weekend, but it also was a big hit in China, I mean in Japan, forgive me, where it's now made total worldwide $32 million. So it's yet another film traveling to China from India and Japan. China is proving a very international market when it comes to the types of movies they are watching. And below that, Black Black Klansman is at $72 million worldwide. Oh, and here's our final film on the list. It's another movie by Rowan Atkinson in his Bond spoof franchise. It's Johnny English Strikes Again. The first two movies made $160 million each worldwide. They both cost about $45 million to make. This one, I don't think is going to – three time is not the charm. $3.3 million on its opening weekend. It opened in six territories, assuming I include – it includes, I assume, the United Kingdom from what I can tell. So not a good start for the – perhaps he went back to the well once too often.
You know, I recently saw Rowan Atkinson driving around Beverly Hills. We came to a four-way stop, you know, where all the corners have to stop, all the directions have to stop. And I saw him and he was looking at me and I was looking at him and I was like, no, you first, sir. And you know, I had the right of way. And he was like, no, you first, sir. And I was like, I'm in a Mr. Bean movie.
Well, I went to the movies this weekend and I saw Museo, I should say, starring Gael García Bernal. A good movie, I thought. Quirky, interesting. It's a fine companion piece to the indie film American Animals. That movie was about sort of sad sack young guys ripping off a rare books room of a library. Museo is about Gail and his friend ripping off a museum of natural history in Mexico. So it's an interesting movie. I liked it. My friend liked it a little less than me, but we both thought it was interesting and well directed.
Well, did you use MoviePass to buy your tickets for that?
I did indeed. It was at Landmark at 57. It's, you know, one of the two theaters in Manhattan you can use your MoviePass at all the time. And it's one of the few movies I could see. So, okay, you know, MoviePass won't let you see movies on certain dates. So, you know, sort of like, oh, I don't want to see anything. MoviePass won't let me. But, you know, I've been released from MoviePass hell. Went to that theater. I'm very, very close to dumping MoviePass once and for all. It's just I don't know where I'm going to be living, so I'm not sure if I should do it.
Well, you know, if you're living in China, you will have, I guess the options will all still be there to buy tickets via your mobile app. And 80% of the tickets, movie tickets sold in China are sold via mobile app. So, you know, that's why there are so many companies trying to break into that space and gain market share in selling movie tickets via mobile in China, to the point where it was basically being subsidized. And, well, the Chinese government is going to crack down.
Did they feel it just enough is enough?
I don't know why they're doing that. I can't figure out why they're doing that other than, you know, it's basically falsely propping up the box office.
But, yes, I feel like there aren't so many new companies coming in. I feel like basically now the market has settled. There are a couple big players, and the government's saying, look, enough of the subsidies. You guys are already in control of your market share. Let's just let movies make what they should make and let people pay full price. And if it's too much, then maybe they should lower the prices. But let's do it in a normal, straightforward way. I think it's healthier for the box office long term, don't you?
I think absolutely. I always said that, the Chinese box office was growing by leaps and bounds and, you know, over the past couple of years. Certainly last year was a little bit more subdued, but wait until these mobile apps stop subsidizing movie ticket prices. We'll see how quickly it continues to grow. So it should be interesting to see.
That's right. A lot is happening in China. And we normally just talk about the box office. We don't get into politics too much. But, you know, it is a totalitarian state. It's a one-party country. There's a lot of freedom is curtailed in China. And that does affect business and affects Hollywood and the roles they play there. And a couple things can remind you of that. One, Fan Bingbing is missing. One of the most famous actresses in Asia is missing. Nobody knows where she is. And the government ain't talking. Where she is, we don't know, but that sort of thing would not happen here in America. You say, hey, where's Julia Roberts? You know, that's just not going to happen.
I mean, the fact that she can just go missing and nobody knows where she is, I mean, how does that happen?
One would think, personal safety, people have gone missing, but usually because they are literally missing as opposed to are incognito or not allowed to be speaking up. You know, that happens, of course. But some things don't go missing, they just stop. That would be what happened to a German touring production of Ibsen's Enemy of the People. It was touring China. They've taken other shows to China before. You might think Ibsen's Enemy of the People was not a great choice. It's a play about government corruption. And in the play, the public baths are a health risk, but the local government doesn't want anyone to know about it because it might spoil tourism. And this particular production, touring, involves talkback, people in the audience being encouraged to speak up and talk about things that are bothering them. And They worried maybe people would be afraid to speak up, but the problem was that people spoke up too much. They said things like, the biggest problem in China is the question of free speech. And the government wasn't so happy about that. And so first they did the show, then they were said, not so much with the audience participation, so they cut that. People shouted out anyway. Then they were told not to say certain lines, so they would perform and then pause and show where a censored moment was, and then they would start again. It has not gone well at all.
Yeah, ironically, it was Fan Bingbing at the opening was the last time she was seen.
That's right. Well, I know that Ann Thompson has been at a lot of openings of movies because she's been hitting the fall film circuit.
Well, that's right. Now does seem like a good time to bring Ann Thompson, editor-at-large over at IndieWire, into the conversation. And as the fall movie season starts and the festival season kind of, I guess it's still going on, it's always good to check in with Anne, who is just getting back from the Toronto International Film Festival after she attended Telluride. Plus, of course, she covers the Emmy Awards, so we have to talk to her about all of these things. But first, Anne, thank you for joining us. And please, I have to say, when I heard about the news about the Oscars getting rid of their popular film category, I immediately thought, I wonder what Anne thinks about that. What did you think?
I think they did the right thing. I have to say, it was interesting. I was up in Telluride, and I had been tracking the progress that the Board of Governors was making in terms of figuring out what the rules were going to be for the supposed best popular film category. And they got such heated blowback, and they got blowback from all their own members and from the media, and Twitter exploded. And, you know, I was not alone in suggesting that this was a terrible idea, and that in a year, and especially if you look at the festivals, speaking of which, there are a number of big studio, popular mainstream movies from the movie that won the Audience Award, Green Book, which is terrific, this Peter Farrelly movie with Mahershala Ali and Viggo Mortensen, who will most certainly get nominated. And then you have A Star Is Born, Bradley Cooper's movie with Lady Gaga, another take on that old chestnut and updated in a very effective and entertaining way, which will be a huge hit. And any number, you know, The First Man is going to be a big movie with, you know, Damon Chazelle's film with Ryan Gosling competing with Bradley Cooper in the Best Actor category, returning after La La Land, playing Neil Armstrong. These are big, big movies. And then you have the ultimate art film, Roma, the Cuarón. So the Academy is trying to go into some future where the Oscar show could be popular. It really depends on the movies that the studios make and the movies that come forward that are worthy of consideration as the best films of the year. And luckily this year, they don't need a best popular film category. They haven't killed it. I hope they have. They're threatening to bring it back next year after they've given it due consideration. I hope it's dead and buried.
Well, the president of the Academy is John Bailey, and he sounded very defensive. He said, you know, people complain that our Best Picture nominees aren't popular and aren't big mainstream movies, and then we try and do something about it, and everybody yells at us.
You know, it's funny, because when I went to EMEA, right before they announced this is the Association of Moving Image Archivists. They had a little conference for over a weekend right before they announced this. And I sat next to him most of the weekend, and I just wanted to shake him and say, what were you thinking?
What's weird about that is that Bailey, who is obviously one of the great cinematographers, and he had a great career as a cinematographer in Hollywood, and he's very smart, and he knows film, and he loves foreign films. You know, he's an erudite, you know, intelligent man. That doesn't mean that he's a good politician, or that he's attuned to all the changes in the industry as much as he might think he is. And he's very invested in this thing, and he took it sort of personally when it didn't work out. And I did an interview with him where I started off by saying, not knowing that he was invested in this as much as he was, I started off by saying, oh, congratulations, you guys did the right thing. This was after they killed it. you know, for the time being. And he was very, you're right. He was totally defensive about it. It put his back up that I would think that there was anything wrong with the best popular film category. I think he should be listening to his members. That's the important thing. Not doing what he thinks is right, but what they want him to do.
And when they are sticking to their guns on the other things they announced, such as keeping a chunk of craft awards off the television, and when they announce which ones are on the firing line this year, there's going to be an uprising.
I actually don't have as much trouble with that as other people do, and I'll explain why. Every single person who wins an Oscar is going to have a moment in the sun where they accept that Oscar, and it will be on the show. It just won't be live, and you won't see the entire length of their trek up the carpet to the stage and they're hemming and hawing and this thing and that, and it'll just be edited down. And I think to have a professional 3-hour show is absolutely to be sought after and probably necessary to keep that show alive. I have no problem with this.
Well, no, I'm saying the craftspeople are going to be up in arms. The cinematographers, the editors.
I think when they see the end result, also they're going to rotate them in and out and everything. I mean, the risk, if they really did have a year where there were no big movies and all, the only way that the big movies were being recognized was in the craft categories, I think that would be really counterproductive, you know, to have if Black Panther only got you know, tech awards. But that's not going to happen. I think Black Panther is going to go all the way.
Well, you saw a number of films over the last several weeks, starting in Telluride in Colorado, which is over Labor Day weekend. And then moving on to the Toronto International Film Festival, TIFF, you saw a number of films that will also be going all of the way. And some of these films, they premiere at Venice, and then they move to Telluride, and then Toronto. Some just start at Telluride and then move to Toronto. Some just play Toronto. But you got to see a number of films at Telluride, which were also at Toronto. Really three big ones. I believe you saw First Man, Roma, and... is it The Favorite that you saw at Telluride?
Yeah. The Favorite is those three films all debuted in Venice and Telluride, and The Favorite skipped Toronto because it's going to be opening night at the New York Film Festival, so they'll get another blast of positive feedback in New York. These are three fabulous movies. All three of these movies are great. Great. And I love them. I love Roma. Roma is head and shoulders above everything else. It's almost as if the three amigos, and if you think about it, you have Alejandro González Iñárritu and Birdman won Best Picture. And then you have Alfonso Cuarón and Gravity got to Best Director. And then you have Guillermo del Toro, and these are all friends, close friends from Mexico, who push each other and inspire each other and critique each other. And I argue that Guillermo winning Best Picture for The Shape of Water, you know, the Cuarón wants to be in the same realm where the personal and the political and the artistic, you know, all come together in an extraordinary way, and that's what Roma is. There's no consideration of commerciality involved in this. It's just he takes the most extraordinary technological sophisticated tools that he knows how to use, in this case a 65mm Alexa, and puts them to use with the most extraordinary long takes and depth of field and black and white that doesn't look like high contrasty black and white. It looks very different, and incredible immersive Dolby Atmos sound, and it's in Spanish, and it's his neighborhood in Roma in Mexico City, and it's a woman who he hired from being a preschool teacher to play his nanny, who still lives with his family in Mexico City. I mean, it's just an extraordinary story that works for audiences too.
And this is Alfonso Cuarón we're talking about. The he here is Alfonso Cuarón.
Alfonso Cuarón trying to, in a good way, to you know, outdo his confreres.
You know, if I knew somebody who wrote books about the industry, I would say there might be a book in this whole, you know, Three Amigos from Mexico thing. You know, this is kind of
look at what they've done.
Yes, I mean, this is a fascinating time period for specifically for, you know, filmmakers coming from Mexico.
Yeah. So this movie, I mean, it's going to be fascinating. Of course, there's a whole Netflix component to this. One of the winners that came out of these festivals was Participant Media. You have to say that under the leadership of David Lindy, these people funded 100%, gave Alfonso Cuarón the money he needed to develop and produce and make this movie for about $15 million. And then they went on the market and Netflix won the bidding, spent a lot to pick up the movie. So the irony, of course, being... and I do think about this. If Roma had been in Cannes, could it have won the Palme d'Or?
Well, that was always, you know, certainly this year at Cannes, the Cannes Film Festival, everybody said, well, gee, we're missing a whole bunch of movies. We're missing Xavier Dolan's film, which did premiere at Toronto, too.
And bombed.
And less than stellar reviews. We're missing Roma, was another one. The Orson Welles documentaries and his films his film was not there. And Roma
The Other Side of the Wind, right?
Yeah, The Other Side of the Wind, thank you. But Roma was one of the big ones. Everybody thought Cuarón would be at Cannes. He wasn't. Instead, he's doing the Fall Festival circuit. Here's my question. It's a Netflix film, which comes with, you know, as far as not only the awards, but with theatrical release, comes loaded with controversy, at least for motion picture exhibitors. They do not want to play a film that can be streamed at the same time. How does this film break through and go beyond where Mudbound went, which was nominated for 4 Academy Awards?
Indeed, which was a remarkable achievement. The movie, of course, deserved it, but it was still for Netflix to accomplish that. So you know that they've basically hired a squadron of publicists and marketing strategists and Oscar pundits, not pundits, but strategists, to campaigners to buttress their marketing efforts. So they now have real pros on staff who are pushing. And by the way, we're involved in a lot of their Emmy wins last night as well, where they actually tied with HBO. So Netflix is a big company in the TV space and the streaming space and the movie space, and they are competitive now. They are going to there's no question that they'll get nominated for Best Picture for Roma. I mean, there's no question in my mind. Already just on the festivals alone, they have accomplished that. And now Roma goes to New York and gets a whole nother wave of plaudits. The theatrical component of this, which of course is usually a prerequisite for a movie building enough buzz to be a must-see, I think Roma's already built that buzz. I think it already has accomplished that. So I don't know, in the world that we live in now, I mean, it will have a theatrical release. They're going to go in major cities, and they're going to be in theaters for a few weeks at least, if not longer, and they're going to do what they have to do to book those theaters. They won't be necessarily the theater chains. As you know, that's not, you know, they're going day and date. So, you know, I think they're booking theaters that they can get, independent theaters.
So you're saying Netflix is not going to change its playbook? They're not going to say, we need to hold off on day and date because this film needs to work in a theater if we want to be an Oscar winner and we want to make it that sort of desirable must-see. And it seems like a film you really want to see on a big screen. They're not going to do that. They're still going to insist on being day and date.
They will never go back on that.
No, that is their
whole...
I agree.
No matter what you've read in some breathless reports, there was a story in the Hollywood Reporter, which turns out to be pretty inaccurate in this regard. There's a lot of speculation. They're keeping their cards... they haven't revealed their entire plan yet. And I keep, like last night at the Emmy party, the Netflix Emmy party, I was sort of pressing Ted Sarandos for a little more information. So we're all learning little bits and pieces of what it might be. It opens December 14th. So between now and December 14th, we can assume they're going to figure out a way to book the theaters they need to show the film, but it will still be day and date.
Do you think this is a mistake in terms of making the film more valuable to them long term? Because if Itu Mama Tambien was day and date, it probably would not have become the big theatrical hit it was on the indie circuit, and probably would not be as valuable or visible to everyone the way it became. So if they do that, do you think they're sort of missing a chance to make this film far more valuable, make more money in the movie theater, and maybe make it more valuable long term? Maybe some films should be seen in a theater.
I think that Roma should be seen in a theater. Don't get me wrong. I believe that 100%. And those people who are lucky enough to live in big cities or cities with festivals, because they're going to be, you know, already, if you live in Venice or you live in Toronto or you live in Telluride, Colorado, or you live in New York, you're going to see Roma. You have the opportunity to see Roma on the big screen, and it will go to the major metropolitan markets for a period of time. But they're not interested in theatrical release. The only reason they do it at all is A, to make the filmmaker happy, and B, to build buzz for the Oscars. And again, I argue, based on all the reviews that have come out, all the buzz, all the, you know, they won the Golden Lion in Venice, you know, they're the Mexican Oscar entry. You know, going forward, I think there's going to be a great amount of noise around Roma, enough. If you want Oscars, if you want branding, if you want that kind of validation that the filmmaker seeks or that the company seeks, you're going to get it. You're going to, you know, this has a real chance to win Best Picture. Do I think that a real theatrical release over a long period of time, the kind of Sony Pictures Classics thing, where you build word of mouth and you build awareness and you know, everybody sees the movie in a theater, would that be ideal? Of course, I think that would be ideal. But they're never going to do that, Netflix. And I don't know that they have to get what they want.
That would be kind of saying, well, our platform is secondary, which they will never do, at least not currently. But
right.
If you look at the Emmys, it used to be, well, if you're not on a broadcast network, if you're on a cable network, you'll never win one of these things, because that's just, you know, they all go to the broadcast networks. And then all of a sudden the cable networks and the HBOs were winning. And then if you weren't on the HBOs or the broadcast networks, if you were streaming, well, forget about it. There was no way you could win an Emmy. Well, now all of a sudden, look at what's been happening over the past several years. Now the streaming shows are winning. I think there will be a film that comes out of Netflix, or maybe even, Amazon's a little different since they're releasing in theaters, but comes out of a streaming only universe, that does win a big Academy Award. And then that will kind of break the dam open. That will rip the Band-Aid off.
Well, I think that could be this year, and we shall see. We shall see. I'm fascinated by this, of course. It's all new and interesting, and I'm fascinated by what Ted Sarandos is going to do. I want to see what he does. I want to see how he threads this particular needle to get where he wants to go.
Seeing people turn Netflix down, Crazy Rich Asians, Birth of a Nation, all for various reasons of pop cultural impact or award hopefuls. If Roma doesn't get a nomination, which I assume is impossible, but say it doesn't get a nomination, will there be a sense of people, wow, you know what? Maybe we're going to think twice before we go to Netflix when we think we got an award winner.
Well, I would say, of course. I mean, isn't Roma so much that I worry about? I have to say, at the festivals, Netflix had a really strong lineup.
They had eight films. Yes, eight films.
Yeah, and so there. And I haven't seen all of them. I last night, Ted Sarandos said, "Did you see The Kindergarten Teacher?" And I was like, "No, that's the one I didn't see." All right, but they had Quincy. They had Nicole Holofcener's The Land of Steady Habits. They had Jeremy Saunier's Hold the Dark. They had Paul Greengrass's 22 July. And plus those two Orson Welles things. I mean, these are all really good movies that maybe we could argue the studios wouldn't have made Okay. They all have reasons for not being overtly commercial, but they're excellent films and a lot of people are going to see them. Are those films going to be in the Oscar conversation? Maybe not so much. Well, that's the risk. There's also Tamara Jenkins coming up in New York with Private Life. That's an excellent film that was at Sundance. That's going to be a long shot to get nominations because they can't mount the same level of attention around all those films, I don't think.
Well, another big winner from this year's festival circuit, or at least the fall festival circuit, was a distribution company, Neon, which is run by Tim League. And out of Alamo Drafthouse, they picked up one of my favorite films from the Cannes Film Festival, the Swedish film Border. But this year at Toronto, they picked up two films, both of them musicals. One is Vox Lux, which stars Natalie Portman, and a documentary from the wildlife cinematographer John Chester.
I did see The Biggest Little Farm, which is a charming audience pleaser, true story, where he and his wife leave the city and buy this land that is looking pretty nude and horrible and messed up, and they turn it into this verdant paradise, but they have a lot of challenges along the way. It's a great movie and it will do very well. Tom Quinn is also part of the Neon team working with the League. He is also very good at doing Oscars. They picked up by Tanya last year. So they're going to try to push Natalie Portman. That's an edgy movie. I'm not sure they'll be able to get there. That turns out that the best actress race is pretty crowded all of a sudden. There's a lot of people vying for those slots. So I wish them well. But maybe the documentary race will work out for them as well.
And stepping back, looking at Toronto and Telluride and Venice and Cannes, has Cannes missed a step by blackballing Netflix? Do you feel like who's up, who's down, or are there any changes, or is just okay, new people with new deep pockets? Today it's Netflix. Last time it was the Weinsteins.
No, I mean, what you see, in my view, is a world order that's shifting, and Cannes isn't keeping up. But it isn't Thierry Frémaux's fault. It's the French exhibitors who are sticking to the sort of antediluvian windows strategy. And apparently, because I did speak to some people from the French industry, they're working hard to change those rules. They're working to make it so that France is competitive in this world, this digital world. They shouldn't have had to let those movies go. I mean, Sarandos and Frémaux are friendly, and it isn't something that Cannes did. It's something the French film industry did. And until they make those changes, they're not going to get those Netflix films. If you have Alfonso Cuarón in the Cannes Film Festival, he better be in the competition. Not, they would have given him like an out of competition opening night slot or something. And that's simply not acceptable at all.
Well, I mean, we could talk about some of the films that we think are going to be in the Best Picture category, or at least in the running, like First Man, Damien Chazelle's film about Neil Armstrong and the landing on the moon landing, or A Star is Born, which ever since Cine Europe, where they started showing it to exhibitors, this is Bradley Cooper's directing debut, as you mentioned, it's a remake. It stars Lady Gaga, and I knew it was going to be a hit since Cine Europe when they started showing it to exhibitors early. We could talk about all of those. But I'm sure we will be in the future. One thing that we haven't talked about are some titles, some content that did actually win awards, which the Emmy Awards were just last night, and you are the awards expert over there at IndieWire, and now you're covering the Emmys. You have been for some time. What did you think of the show last night?
I was not very taken with the show or with the hosts or with the silly comedic bits. The idea that Lorne Michaels, would take his Saturday Night Live cronies and sort of throw them into the show and showcase them almost as if he's trying to promote his own show that ended up winning, an Emmy. The whole thing felt very inside baseball. I got a kick out of the Oscar director who ended up proposing to his future wife. That was pretty good use of live television from an expert in live television who knew exactly what he was doing. What I liked about the show is something that the Oscars could use, which is that it was unpredictable. The races were close. You didn't know exactly what was going to win. I'm on Gold Derby, this site, my sister site at Penske Media, where they have all the different people picking the winners. A lot of surprises. I mean, Claire Foy was not the front runner to win Best Actress. Americans and Game of Thrones and Handmaid's Tale were very close, and The Crown all closely, and they all picked up a few wins, but it was hard to pick which ones they were going to pick up. So I found that very, very satisfying, and very satisfying indeed that Amazon's Marvelous Mrs. Maisel did so well. That was extraordinary.
I'm happy that The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel did so well. It's a great show. I was a little surprised that Game of Thrones won yet again. I thought for sure they could pick another, maybe a drama series that hasn't won, and The Americans is going out, so maybe send it off,
Well, Matthew Reese got to win, and the writers got to, they picked up a few things.
I was surprised it didn't win Best Actress.
I was shocked that was a very close race. I thought Elizabeth Moss would win Best Actress just because she carried Handmaid's Tale. Here's the other thing. What used to be true of the Emmys, and in a horrifying, sort of boring way, was that they just kept going back to the same old, and so there is a kind of trope that you could expect somebody who's won before to win again. That did not happen so much last night. There were a lot more new shows that won. Now, one example of a new show that didn't win was my favorite, Patrick Melrose, and I went over to Benedict Cumberbatch at the Netflix party. Everybody ended up at the Netflix party. Kit Harington ended up there. All the Brits ended up there. But he should have won for Patrick Melrose, not Darren Criss. But there it is. It's the Emmys. It's a popularity contest, and a lot of people didn't see a new show like Patrick Melrose.
Well, I know that, speaking of them repeating, the Emmys repeating time and again, the same nominees and the same winners, Michael Giltz is very upset that Modern Family wasn't nominated or didn't win. He's very, very upset.
Yeah, I was glad that Marvelous Mrs. Maisel won as well, because it felt like reparations for Gilmore Girls. That
right.
Show was about a mother and her daughter, co-created by a woman, and they couldn't get anything. They got one nomination and one win for Makeup, one of the best reviewed shows of all time, along with Buffy at the same era. Now it's nice to know that this show broke through, though I fear it will now win Best Comedy for the next 4 years in a row.
I'm wondering if those rules still apply. I mean, Handmaid's Tale won a lot last year, including drama and actress, and this year it got nothing. So maybe we're in a new era.
Maybe, though, I'm next year, Veep and Game of Thrones will be saying goodbye, so I won't be shocked if they both win
right
comedy and drama.
What I would say is if you're going to have presenters give out an award, you should probably make sure they know how to say all of the nominees' names in case one of them wins.
Yeah.
I could not believe. So Rachel Brosnahan wins for The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, Best Actress in a Comedy Series. And they said her first name. She knew she had won. She's the only Rachel. And then they could not pronounce the last name.
Duh.
Yeah.
Really?
Well, they should put phonetic spelling down there. But also, one of the bad things that they did was they would announce the nominees, show clips, all too brief, then bring out the presenters, then do some banter, and then announce the winner, by which point you've forgotten who was nominated.
Yes.
It's one of the many problems of the pacing of the show, which was, I thought, deadly dull. The hosts were terrible. Most of the bits were terrible. Everything just dragged. Then you had Will Ferrell strolling out, making his joke about walking. It's like, no, we want you to run and get this over with. But oh well, it's a TV show. It's people win who shouldn't, people lose who should have won. It happens every year.
What was the deal with Betty White coming out? 96 years old. I thought maybe this wasn't such a good idea, as she kind of mumbled her way through an acceptance speech. What
know,
was that?
But it was Betty White, and everybody wishes her well.
Oh, everybody, yeah.
But maybe I have to say, when the Oscars do the same thing and they bring out somebody really old, you go, oh, maybe not such a good idea.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and as far as covering the Oscars and covering the Emmys, the amount of press the Emmys are getting more and more these days, and it might be because, you know, there are 9 trillion television shows on now. It seems to me the Emmys are out-sparkling, out-shining the Oscars more and more. Do you feel that way covering it?
I would say that it has to do with how our lives have changed in terms of our habits, and we all are watching more great television. It is in fact a golden age for extraordinary stuff. I got to talk to Jean-Marc Vallée at the HBO party about Sharp. I'm losing my mind. Sharp Objects. I love that movie and that series. And again, was it a movie? Was it a series? He directed all the episodes. He had a showrunner, but the showrunner didn't need to supervise him that much. And, you know, it's that kind of changes that are occurring in our world where that kind of great filmmaker brings his expertise to bear on a series, and it gives us something wonderful to experience. So I see so much overlap and so much rich continuing content on both media, and so I think we're all to the better. Do I worry about Hollywood? Do I worry about not if Netflix is part of the world now? And I think that with they and Amazon, and we're going to have Apple in there. We're going to have other players in there. I think it's just all going to become one great filmed content stream, and the world that you and I know from theatrical, it's not going to be the same.
That's true, and there's so much good TV. No one can watch it all, and that includes the Emmy Awards, because the ratings are just out. It's the lowest rated Emmy of all time. Ooh. 10.17 million viewers.
Wow.
You know, one thing I will say, as much as the interest in the Emmys is higher than it used to be, it doesn't compare to the interest in the Oscars. If you measure what people look at on, you know, Twitter or the way that they click on stories on the site at IndieWire, and, you know, which stories get traffic, and the Oscars are still pretty mighty. I mean, I worry about them, but they're pretty big.
Well, I'm sure we'll be talking to you, if not before then certainly during the Oscar season. And it's always a pleasure to talk to you, especially after Toronto and Telluride. And now, of course, the Emmys, you know, everything lined up perfectly for us. So thank you, Ann Thompson, editor-at-large over at IndieWire.com. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Always a pleasure, gentlemen. And Sperling, I will see you on the Croisette in May.
Yes. Well, probably before then as well.
I hope so.
Yes.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Thank you, Anne, and thank you, Jesus.
Goodbye, Michael.
A nice little touch there, kind of commenting on what Michael Che said over at the Emmys, that white people never thank Jesus enough.
Yeah, I'm sure they got the joke. Yes.
Well, I always appreciate it when we get a chance to talk to Anne, and she always helps us out with, you know, the Emmy Awards, the Oscars, and the fall festival season. And you know what? You, Michael, always help not only the listeners of Showbiz Sandbox out, but anybody that goes to bookfilter.com, you help them find out what books they should be reading on any given week or month. You kind of look at all the books being published and give us a few that we should be reading. Here at Showbiz Sandbox, you bring those that are ripe for adaptation for movies or television shows. What have you got for us this week?
That's right. This week, everyone is reading Fear by Bob Woodward. It sold about 750,000 copies in its first day on sale. In fact, there were bulk purchases from some foreign embassies where all the employees wanted to read up and see what was going on. But in fact, what I hear is that in DC, the book is not having as much of an impact. Basically, they say, yeah, we knew all that. There's nothing in the book that made them, yeah, we kind of knew. We knew this is all happening. So it's having a bigger impact in the rest of the country, perhaps, than it is in DC. But there's another book coming out on Tuesday. It's The Labyrinth of the Spirits by Carlos Ruiz Zafón. And it's the fourth and final volume in a series that began with The Shadow of the Wind. That was a huge bestseller. And all these books take place over decades in a sort of vaguely alternate world. It's basically our world, but it's called the Cemetery of Forgotten Books world. And in this final volume, they tackle Franco's Spain, a giant conspiracy, and there's also a beautiful and enigmatic heroine. So these are hugely popular books worldwide. he's probably the most successful author in the Spanish-speaking world right now, but he's also a big seller in the UK and the United States and elsewhere. So I am puzzled by the fact that nobody has tried to tackle these books, whether they should be a TV show or a miniseries or movies. I don't know. And I'm sure it's not easy to do because these are sort of erudite books. But nonetheless, I'm still surprised it hasn't happened yet.
Well, I don't know. Is the last book written yet? Because if it's
anything... This is it. This is the fourth and final book in the quartet.
Just checking, because I know that if it's anything like Game of Thrones, I mean, there George R.R. Martin was up on stage accepting that award for best drama series with the whole cast and crew. And I wanted to say, George, get back to the typewriter, okay?
Yes, yes, that's the easiest joke of all to make. I made it myself.
Okay.
Well, but nobody's joking at 60 Minutes, are they?
No, and that brings us to our sexual misconduct news for the week. And there is a lot of new. You know, it's been a year since we've had this segment on the show, and I keep thinking, well, you know, at some point we'll get to not have this segment on the show. And
if we're lucky, we'll have it every week for the rest of our lives.
I hope not. I hope that, you know, we can at some point say, hey, you know, a couple of weeks have gone by where nobody's been, you know, thrown in jail, in movie jail, TV jail, or real jail for sexual misconduct. This week, it's Jeff Fager, the longtime producer of 60 Minutes, who was with CBS for 36 years. He was the chairman of CBS News, and he'd been producing 60 Minutes 14 years, as I mentioned. I guess he did not get fired for sexual misconduct, by the way. No, he got fired for sending a threatening text message to somebody who was a journalist investigating CBS News, in particular his role at CBS News and the misogynistic...
Not even really. They were just doing a piece for CBS News saying a new article has come out in the New Yorker. We need to cover it. And she called him for a comment, and then he threatened her with his text. Some people described it as a text asking her to be fair. Like, no, 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 no. He said, if you repeat this and do this without any reporting of your own, you will be responsible for harming me. Be careful. There are people who lost their jobs trying to harm me. And if you pass on these damaging claims without your own reporting to back them up, that will become a serious problem. End quote. Are you kidding me? He's the head of CBS News, and he's telling a reporter, do not do that. How dare you? Like, unless he completely re-reports the story beyond what the New Yorker did, he's going to, you know, destroy her career. So he should have been fired for that alone.
You know, if he had left himself out of it and just said, look, you have to do your own reporting here. You
can't. Of course, and no comment, or, you know, I deny everything. Yeah.
Right. Then that would have been fine. Why he would send a text message? I mean, you don't send anything like this. I'm not saying you should even say it, but...
Well, you also certainly look the other way when people like Charlie Rose and other people are enabled to sexually harass and misconduct all the time. So, you know, it's true that he has significant support at 60 Minutes. Much of the leadership team under him are women.
Right.
Many believe that what he's accused of pales in comparison to the allegations against Les Moonves. And should we call him Les Moonves, by the way? L-E-S-S? Les Moonves and the newsmen have been caught up in the Me Too movement, like Charlie Rose. Nonetheless, what he did is wrong, and he should be out.
Well, he is now. Speaking of people who are out at CBS, Julie Chen will be leaving the talk. She was one of the hosts of the talk, and she is staying with Big Brother, but that's not a show where she talks about her own personal life. So
right, it's just impossible to be on the talk and be in the news every day and not be talking about it, because you're in the news, it's your life, and what they do is talk about their lives. Like the chit-chat at the beginning of the show, they bring up their lives all the time. That just becomes untenable when you're at the center of a controversy like this. So that's a shame for her that her husband's misconduct means she has lost out on yet something else.
Well, and her husband is Les Moonves, who you were just referring to there, and Linda Bloodworth Thomason, who is a producer, and she used to be a writer as well.
She's a creator, a producer. No, yeah, of course, she's multi-talented, yes.
Yeah, she produced and created Designing Women and its spinoff Evening Shade. She had
That's a spinoff?
I think so. I'm pretty sure. Maybe not. I don't know. But at the end of the day, she had a $50 million deal at CBS when Les Moonves took over in 1995. And she said, like, he just kept stringing her along. He basically got rid of Designing Women and Evening Shade, and every single project she took to the network was basically batted down. And finally,
he was a bastard.
Yeah. I mean, just on a massage, she's not saying, oh, and he tried to touch me and he tried to,
But he harassed her and made her, you know, she was at the peak of her career. Designing Woman was a hot show. Evening Shade was a hot show. She was at her peak years of creativity and power. And he just blocked her completely and stymied her career for no good reason. Bette Midler wanted to do a sitcom with her. He said no. He liked Huey Lewis of Huey Lewis and the News. They were trying to do something with him. And Huey Lewis said, I want her to do my to write my pilot. He killed the deal with Huey Lewis. I mean, and everything she brought him, he said, oh, it's great, but we're not going to do it.
Right, which is a way of keeping somebody strung along. You know, when you have a deal like that, you kind of have to keep them working and writing, even if you never plan on putting anything on the air.
Right, but he could have just said, go away, go somewhere else. She would have been happy to do it. She liked it to get work done. But the point is, she wrote a great Schadenfreude piece for Variety there where she detailed all of this and just said, she cursed at him and said, I basically don't talk like that, but here you go.
Yeah, she started off by saying, I've always been taught you don't, kick a person when they're down, and this was going to be a nice piece, where I played nice and looked.
Screw that.
And she said, you know what? Yeah, screw that.
I'm sorry. She wrote it for the Hollywood Reporter. I beg your pardon. I was looking at a link to another story. So she had it was very funny. You read it and you read what her deal was, and boy, this is a vindictive guy. I guess you're that powerful and big. Maybe a lot of people are vindictive and nasty, but it's pretty nasty and hateful, so it's a bummer to see.
Well, and it backs up exactly the story that we heard about Janet Jackson, where he was really upset over the Super Bowl incident and was very upset that she got a book deal with Simon & Schuster.
Yeah, and you're like, really? Like, don't you have better things to do? Like, why would you care that much? I know Norm MacDonald has better things to do. He just keeps apologizing and keeps not working. He has a new talk show that debuted on Netflix to really poor reviews, I should say. I don't know why anyone would think he'd be a good talk show host because he's not even a very good talk show guest. But anyway, he gave an interview to Hollywood Reporter and he felt bad about Louis C.K. and Roseanne, who are friends of his. And rather stupidly, he said, of course, people will go, what about the victims? But you know what? The victims didn't have to go through that, meaning losing their careers and their jobs or whatever, to which people said, well, their lives were kind of destroyed in a day too, People who are sexually assaulted or misconduct, their lives get, upended in a day as well. So he realized he messed up. He's trying to promote a show. And he went to apologize. And where did he go?
He went to the Howard Stern show. First of all, don't go to a show that is, I don't want to say it's a small audience, but because it's not necessarily a small audience.
That's not a small audience, but that's just not where you go to apologize.
Right, exactly. It's just
Howard Stern is not the place to make,
it's a select audience. It's a select audience.
Well, no, it's not the audience. It's the fact that this is not a platform for doing that. Howard Stern is about pushing the envelope and getting you to say things you don't want to say.
Right.
You go to People Magazine to apologize. It's not his audience or him. He's not doing anything wrong. That's just not the right environment to apologize for an insensitive comment. They feast on insensitive comments. And in fact, this idiot, Norm MacDonald, went on Howard Stern and said, of course he feels sympathy for the victims. Quote, you'd have to have Down syndrome, end quote, not to feel for them. I mean, oh my God.
From the frying pan directly into the fire.
What an offensive idiot. And he ends that interview by saying, I'm stupid. I wish I didn't have to give interviews. And I'm like, yeah.
Yeah, you probably shouldn't.
We agree with you. And you know what? You sound like someone who really shouldn't have a talk show where you have to deal with things and think on your feet and make sure you can keep the ball rolling. That's not what he's good at.
Yeah, well, he probably won't have a talk show in not too long.
Well, if it does well, maybe they don't care.
Yeah.
But we were talking about A Star is Born with Anne Thompson, and she mentioned how this is really an Oscar hopeful. Every previous version of A Star is Born has been a big hopeful, except, of course, for the Barbara Streisand version. I think that got a nomination for Song, but that was sort of a critical bomb and a big box office hit. It's always been popular, all three iterations. This is the fourth one. It's going to be a hit, too. It may well be in the Oscar talk. That's what they say. But John Peters was one of the producers of that 1970s train wreck, and he, of course, has a cloud over him now as part of this sexual misconduct era, and apparently they just found out about that.
Well, I would say this. John Peters having a cloud over him for sexual misconduct, he kind of comes with a cloud of sexual misconduct. I mean, this is a guy that started out as a hairdresser, okay? Wound up
Nothing wrong with hairdressers.
No, I'm just hear me out here. Winds up you know, kind of dating Barbara Streisand, producing this movie, A Star Is Born. And then he teams up with Peter Guber, and they start making movies together, like Flash.
Hugely successful. They hugely do drugs. Successful. They have sex. They make tons of money. Lots of big splashy movies. They run a studio into the ground. Blah blah blah.
Sony. They were picked to when Sony bought Columbia Pictures. They were picked to run it. They ran it into the ground. And yeah,
we could have done a better job.
Yeah, they had. You know, certainly John Peters has had a cloud of sexual misconduct surrounding him for years, for a decade or more.
Right. So he is connected to this movie. He is in the credits list, but the Producers Guild of America has weighed in, and they say on this version of the film, he is not one of the producers of note, meaning he will not be eligible for an Oscar. Some people were worried, oh no, they won't want to honor the film because it might unintentionally honor John Peters. Well, that's not going to happen. So I don't think that would have been a real factor anyway. It seems silly. He's not really the heart and soul of the film, so who the hell would care? But it isn't an issue because he will not be one of the people who could step on the stage and get an award. So that little, you know,
he's basically the guy that owned the rights. So that you had.
Well, he had the most recent rights. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it's been around since before he was born. So, you know, it's been around a long time.
Correct.
All right. So he's out of the picture in terms of winning an Oscar. So you can like A Star Is Born or not, but you don't have to worry about John Peters any more than you have to worry about First Man being un-American, which was a silly nonsense that will hopefully have faded soon.
Yes, that story, I was surprised, got so much press.
Well, like, I think Buzz Aldrin fed it, and I think he's just a little jealous that it's yet another thing where he's overshadowed by Neil Armstrong. But anyway, I think it's a big whoop when all is said and done.
Ooh. Thank you very much for helping me along, because it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, well, you know what? The fall from grace for CBS continues, this time in the ratings. For the first time in 16 years, NBC is on top in total viewers for an entire year. It's also number one in every major demographic, including a huge 38% advantage in the key 18 to 49 demo. The last time one network triumphed in every demo was a decade ago when Fox ruled the roost thanks to American Idol and other hits. NBC, of course, has been boosted by the drama This Is Us, Sunday Night Football, summer shows like America's Got Talent, and one-off events like the Super Bowl and the Winter Olympics. Heck, Saturday Night Live hit its biggest ratings in 23 years, and that doesn't even go toward this primetime victory. Big deal or big whoop?
Hey, not so fast here. I say big whoop because for the season, rather than the 52-week calendar year, CBS is still number one in primetime during the regular season. NBC was right on its heels, and it clawed its way to victory thanks to summer shows like America's Got Talent, which is just about to have its season finale. So they both still have bragging rights, and CBS is still big in daytime and late night. It's number one there as well, I think. So it's CBS is doing just fine.
Musical acts have been plagued by a venue war. We've talked about this before. If you wanted to play the O2 Arena in the UK, then you had to book the Staples Center in LA. But if you wanted to play Madison Square Garden in New York, you had to play the Forum in LA. It was enough to make an artist want to live stream a concert from their living room and be done with it. Or alternatively, file a lawsuit. That's what Ozzy Osbourne did, and now he may be able to drop his lawsuit because the companies behind all these venues say they are dropping the block booking tactic. Who do we thank for this? Who knows? AEG says they dropped their block booking policy for the O2 because Irving Azoff's company dropped its policy for Madison Square Garden. MSG says they never had a block booking policy. All I want to know is, can they get me good seats to the Elton John farewell tour? Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop because they both did it voluntarily, which means they can both start it up again voluntarily. It was asinine and bad for everyone, even for them, I think, and certainly not good for fans. And I wish there'd been a legal ruling so we could say you can't do that. Since they're just stopping it for the moment, I'll have to say it's a big whoop.
An actress in the West End revival of the musical 42nd Street is making history. She went on maternity leave for 6 months, and now she has returned to her job, but not full-time. Actress Charlene Ford will be sharing her role with Jenny Legg, which actually, appropriate name for somebody
It's a dancer. Music, yeah. Right. And Charlene is sharing. That's nice, too.
Yes. Jenny Legg is the performer who took over the part during maternity leave. Now, Ford will do 3 shows a week. Legg will do 5 shows a week. And everyone is happy. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a very big deal. A lot of women say their careers get derailed in the theater world if they take off any time for a kid. They lose out on roles. They can't accommodate a schedule of a family. Producers say, no, we want the same cast at every show, which is nonsense because a lot of shows will have even the lead performer not do a certain matinee, like that's happening with My Fair Lady. Well, when they step in, they won't be doing the Sunday matinees. Other shows just have parts that are too demanding. When you have swings or smaller parts or roles, people are out sick, they're on holiday, this, that, and the other thing. It's a Tuesday. So people are in and out all the time. Obviously, you want the big draws to be there all the time. But when you're talking about someone in a secondary role or in the chorus, it seems petty not to accommodate people's real life. And if there are 2 actors willing to accommodate each other and make this happen, hopefully this will keep happening more and more. It's happening in the UK. I look forward to the day it happens on Broadway.
Now, this next story, you always said you can't buy happiness and you can't buy time, right? That's
true.
What this next story is about. A newspaper or magazine is the new must-have among the world's wealthy. Jeff Bezos of Amazon, of course, bought the Washington Post. The widow of Steve Jobs, Lauren Powell Jobs, bought the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Now the billionaire owner of Salesforce has purchased Time magazine.
Oh, he bought Time. I get it.
Yeah, see? He bought Time. Mark and Lynn Benioff paid $190 million for the iconic magazine. Presumably, that should at least get them on the cover, right? I mean, come on. The current owners met with tons of potential buyers, but avoided those looking for quick returns or a refusal to focus on journalism. They turned down a $325 million offer for 3 Time Inc. titles from David Pecker, the Trump confidant and owner of the National Enquirer. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I guess it was either that or a new yacht, right?
Or, he has one of the tallest buildings in San Francisco. He basically changed the skyline of San Francisco.
It makes me uncomfortable that journalism and a free press needs to depend on the whims of the wealthy, but that's the world we live in, and I guess it harkens back to the age of the Medicis. Better that than a yacht, I suppose. It's not a great thing long term, but I'm glad they've done it if they keep their hands off it and let it be independent.
Which is exactly what, according to many, what Jeff Bezos has done with the Washington Post.
Yeah.
And they've kind of thrived under his ownership so far.
I wouldn't know because they have it blocked, so I can't read the stories.
Oh, really?
Well, you have to subscribe.
Oh, okay. Do you use a streaming service like Spotify?
I do.
If you're like most people, you might have never noticed there's a limit to how many songs you can download for offline listening. After all, with the limit being 3,333, you could download 200 or more albums at a time. Most people never, ever buy 200 albums in their entire lifetime. But if you're a heavy music listener, like, say, my co-host Michael...
Hey, that's me.
Then the 333 song limit drives you nuts. Well, Spotify just raised that limit. Now you can download 10,000 songs for offline listening. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. People have this music on multiple devices. There are 230 million people worldwide who subscribe to streaming. I think the estimate is that it generates about $7 billion a year right now, and that's just going to keep growing. Amazon's music is still gaining popularity, and I think if Spotify wants to stay on top, they need to do things like this and say, oh, we know we've got a subset of really heavy-going music listeners who want more tracks. You know what? If we want to not keep them jumping to Apple or somebody else, we better accommodate them. So they did.
Sir Paul McCartney continues to make history. His new album, Egypt Station, debuts at number 1 on the Billboard charts. It's his first album to debut at number 1, and the first to hit number 1 since Tug of War back in 1982. That 36-year span between number 1s is the biggest in history, except for the late Johnny Cash, who had a posthumous number 1 that was 36 years and a few months longer than Macca. By the way, Macca is what those of us in the know call Sir Paul McCartney. Only Barbara Streisand, or Babs, as those of us in the know like to call her, only she has a bigger span of number 1 albums, even if you include McCartney's time in the Beatles. He wasn't the only one making news. Christian artist Lauren Daigle made like Amy Grant and broke onto the pop charts with her new album debuting at number 3. Like McCartney, her album sales were goosed with a concert ticket album bundle. But hey, a sale is a sale, especially these days. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal. I couldn't be more delighted for Paul. He's not in the top spot in the UK, however. He debuted at number 3. Eminem is at number 1, and the number 2 album, this kind of hurts, is the soundtrack to The Greatest Showman, that Hugh Jackman film. He couldn't sell more copies than that, which has been around for ages. So that's a shame, but it's cool to see Paul on top again. The first solo Paul album I bought was, in fact, Tug of War, way back in 1982.
Say.
Well, that's the next album, Pipes of Peace.
I said I'm going to make this joke, and I will. I'm certain that Michael will immediately correct me and say that that song was not on Tug of War. But we still got more streaming.
Yeah, you will say what?
I am shocked that this is the first solo album by Paul McCartney to debut at number 1. I would have thought
no. Well, no, because before the SoundScan era, only 6 albums in history debuted at number 1. Didn't happen.
Okay.
Yeah, so that is not a slight against Paul. That just didn't happen in the old days. You just did not debut at number 1. The way the charts were done, the methodology, how they collected the info, it just didn't happen.
And since I was alive in 1982, can we refrain from referring to them as the old days?
No, we cannot. But we have more streaming talk to do, so keep going.
Well, superfans are gaming the system, really, so their favorite acts can rank high on the Billboard charts. Harry Styles fans made sure his first single scored highly by encouraging everyone to stream the song nonstop. Hey, if a fan is willing to play a song 100 times in a row, isn't that worth something? Fans of the K-pop boy band BTS went further. They set up thousands of Spotify accounts and then offered them up to fans around the world. The plan was for people to stream their new album on multiple devices around the clock. With 140 million users worldwide, knowing that a few thousand racked up tons of streams doesn't sound like a lot. Until you consider that no other new act has thousands of their fans all doing the same thing the week their album debuts. Billboard says every time they create a new metric, people try to game the system, and they'll keep taking measures to ensure the integrity of the charts. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. I agree with, I'm sure it's having an effect, but I get their idea. Hey, look, you know, this is what people do. It doesn't matter how we get the charts. You know, people are going to mess with it any way they can. And in fact, if you look at it, that BTS album, Love Yourself Answer, is now down at number 15. So that fell pretty quickly. Whereas maybe Eminem and some of the other big acts like Drake, they're still in the top 5 because their fans are really listening and playing to them. And they're not sort of this trick. So, you know, it matters. They're paying attention to it. They're trying to fix it. And you know how we feel, that they should have an entirely new chart where they keep streaming separate, because it's just not the same. You cannot compare streaming to album sales, but I've said it before and I won't say it again.
Well, here's the thing. This is easy to fix. All you got to do if you're Spotify is the numbers that you give to Billboard, although I don't know whether Billboard's getting them automatically or not, or actually getting them from Spotify, you just take out all new accounts that have only played one artist. That's easy. You know,
that's an easy fix. Yeah. You can spot a fake account that way.
Right, exactly. But that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
Now, I'm so excited.
Now, here's the thing, okay? And we had a lot of listeners email dirt@showbizsandbox.com, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, with this story. And normally, I would say, speaking of Big Deal or Big Whoop, this is a big deal. And I would say it impacts mostly people in the European Union because it is an EU ruling. However, the internet knows no borders. So unfortunately, it will impact everybody.
And more importantly, it's a big story, and it could affect copyright law in North America and everywhere else around the world. And I think we already had it in the show notes. The second I saw it, I was like, ooh, this is a really interesting, odd, complex story. But I'm delighted that so many people sent it into us. That's very cool. Thank you so much for making sure that it was on our radar.
So here's what happened. So the European Union has kind of passed new copyright laws. And there are certain articles, okay, And
Article 11 and Article 13 are the big ones.
Yes. And earlier versions were fought by everybody in the tech and music industry. But now, you know, it was passed by a significant margin. Article 11 is dubbed the link tax. Okay. And what they say is if you link to outside content, like we're doing now with the New York Times or Billboard or, you know, in our show notes, we link every week, you have to pay to be a content aggregator. So Google News, that's really who they're after here, is Google News. People
and go, Facebook.
And Facebook and Twitter. And
yeah, and all the big multi-trillion dollar companies. Yeah.
Right. And so they're saying, you know, you can't just be linking off, that your business can't be linking to other people's businesses, okay?
Well, more importantly, they're saying all this valuable content is being created and you are profiting from it, but you are not paying for it. And we think that should end because that content is really important, a free press, and therefore we want it to get a fair share of the profits that you're generating from their stuff. It's just like saying you can't use my album and stream it and then make all the money.
Right. And so what they're saying is, hey, a lot of people just go to Facebook or they just go to Twitter, they read the headline, and then they don't go any further. So they don't click through to...
But you can tell what's going on and you can charge accordingly.
Right, exactly. Or you're taking a paragraph out of the story and putting it underneath the link, which effectively means people don't need to click through. And therefore, you, Google or Twitter or Facebook or insert name of aggregator, you're getting money for the page view or the advertising on that page, but the news source is not. So that's Article 11.
And that sounds good. Whether it's able to be done in practice, I don't know. But certainly Facebook and Twitter and Google are making a gazillion dollars off providing access to this content. And people are coming there to share that content. So the idea that the content creators should get a cut of the pie appeals to me. Whether they figured out the best way to do it, I don't know. I know it doesn't mean that you and I, if we post something on our Facebook page, would have to fork over a Bitcoin. That's not going to happen. But the shell company providing the platform where you do it, they will.
Correct.
You know, I don't know if they figured it out, but I like the idea.
Yeah, well, you know, there are a couple problematic provisions like the sharing thing that we just talked about. And, you know, what constitutes a use? Is it, you know, hey, like we have a list of links in our show notes every week so that you can go and read the original stories that we've discussed here on the show. But, you know, what about Wikipedia, for instance? It's a nonprofit organization. It's non-commercial use. It's really sourcing the original content.
I'm gonna guess that they will figure out a way not to make Wikipedia pay a gazillion dollars. It's nonprofit, and they don't include any of the content in the site, really. They write their own original content, and then they politely link to the original story. That's very different from showing a headline and a couple paragraphs from a New York Times article where you are actually just saying, here's that article.
Right. Or
they're
even two sentences
sometimes. They're not transforming it in any way.
Yeah. I mean, two sentences can give you like, I read the headline, I read the two sentences, I get it. Moving on.
Right.
So Article 13, two articles down, is for folks like YouTube or SoundCloud or any place that allows you to upload content.
So Twitter, Blogger,
yes.
Google. Yeah.
And basically what they want is for all of these companies to block the copyright infringing material before it gets posted. So instead of having it get posted, having a takedown notice, having the counter to the takedown notice, having that whole rigmarole, they basically just want it blocked out of the starting gate. You upload, you know, if I uploaded Michael Jackson's Beat It or Paul McCartney, or hey, I just mentioned the song Say, Say, Say. If I upload that it would be blocked before it ever saw the light of day. Well,
on the other hand, they also want it to be really easy for you to say, hey, you've made a mistake, which sounds a little counterfactual or counterintuitive. They want it to be automatically stuff blocked, but they also want a user to be able to say, hey, you blocked me when you shouldn't have, like us when we were blocked for posting a silent clip from a film trailer meant to promote a movie in which they said anyone can show this. We did that and we got blocked by YouTube.
Right. So we were it was fair use. Okay. Because there was no audio on it. And we were talking over it, in fact, and they were using, you know, a video algorithm to depict that, to find it out. And then we were taken down. And
so
that was frustrating because we constantly had to go back and it took our time. And it was just kind of a nightmare. to be honest.
Right. So Article 11 is a good idea. At least I support it. I don't know if they've figured out the way to do it. Article 13 is also sort of what people want to happen in a way, but we know it doesn't work well. We know the filters that they try to use are a disaster. That they, you know, block stuff that shouldn't be blocked and let through stuff that shouldn't be let through. So it's not, there's no system in place ready to do what they want. So that's a problem.
Well, and of course, the music industry loves this because, you know, one of the big things that they have a problem with is people posting music online. And when you have, you know, 2 million minutes of video and audio being uploaded every second, it's impossible to police it all. So, you know, by the time you figure out that somebody's uploaded your latest song, well, it's been 4 weeks.
Right. So the BPI loves it. They said the reforms are great news for music fans and for anyone who values exciting and original online entertainment. And they think it's a step towards a, quote, fairer internet that encourages and rewards creativity. The big thing to remember here is this isn't over. There are now lots of negotiations taking place. What they're actually going to do will be worked out now. That will be hopefully set in place by the end of the year. So we've got a couple months before they figure out, okay, this is what we think we want to do. How are we actually going to do this? I mean, they've been worrying about that already, but this is by no means set in stone in any way, shape, or form in terms of what they specifically do and how they implement it. So one of the person who led the push for reform, Axel Voss, he's a member of the European Parliament, he said, quote, "I am very glad that despite the very strong lobbying campaign by the internet giants, there is now a majority in the full House backing the need to protect the principle of fair pay for European creatives." We'll have to see if they're able to come through with that and get some stuff that allays some of the fears that people have and makes this work. But it's definitely going to be something everyone's looking at all over the world.
Well, yeah, because it basically breaks the internet. I mean, at least Article 11 breaks the internet. I mean, that's...
Well, it doesn't break because you don't know how they're going to implement it. So it doesn't break it because you don't know exactly what they're going to do yet. Making Google pay a small fee for linking or linking to stuff or allowing things to be linked on their site doesn't break it. Facebook can say, well, all right, you can't post New York Times articles anymore. All you can do is post your family photos that you own the rights to. That's the worst case scenario if they don't want to pay anything.
Well, I can tell you this. The GDPR, which is all European Union based, was a nightmare for people like us to try and implement. And it's caused no end.
Did they ever figure it out or is it still a nightmare? Or
Yeah, because trying to comply with it when it first launched May 25th of this year was a nightmare to comply with. And then ongoing to comply, it's just very, very difficult. They're taking something, a hyperlink, which is how the internet started, linking a word or a phrase to another page. That's how it started, and that's how the internet began.
We just did a story about how only newspapers and magazines are rescued when a billionaire can be bothered to do so. Our free press is drying up, and we can see the impact that has on our society. They are providing content that is making Google and Facebook hugely profitable. And they're just saying, we need to fix this because they're generating gazillions of dollars in income and seeing none of it. So let's solve that problem. And that is a problem. So you can scream that they're going to break the internet, or you can say, yeah, it is a problem that Google and Facebook are profiting wildly from all this content, and yet the people who create the content don't make anything. That's a problem. Either you think that's a problem or you don't. Voss says, quote, "Once the dust has settled, the internet will be as free as it is today. Creators and journalists will be earning a fairer share of the revenues generated by their works, and we will be wondering what all the fuss was about."
Well, I hope he's
may be
right.
Wrong, but that's what he wants to happen, and that's what everybody should want to happen.
Well, I hope for all of our sakes, he is correct.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that for all our sakes, that when Maren Mazzie died, a big Broadway star, that they went from insulting her to doing the right thing. She died of ovarian cancer at 57. She was most recently on Broadway in the revival of The King and I. She replaced Kelly O'Hara when Kelly O'Hara moved on. I saw her in Passion, one of my favorite shows of all time. She was terrific. Saw her in the revival of Kiss Me, Kate. I didn't see her in The King and I, but she's a wonderful figure. Been fighting ovarian cancer for years. She died at 57. Very sad. And they were going to dim some of the Broadway lights. Apparently, if you're not a big enough star, they will dim the lights of the Broadway houses where you performed. It's like they will go to the bother of dimming the lights, but not do it at all. That, well, you're just a grip, you know. So it's like either do it or don't do it. Like if you either want to say, okay, they're not big enough, then let's just dim a few. No, either don't do it or do it. And in her case, of course, she deserved all the lights to go off. And people said, are you kidding me? And so they finally said, okay, okay, yeah, you're right, right. So they are going to dim all the lights at Broadway for Mare and Maisie. I've actually never watched that happen. People stand upstairs bar at Sardi's and they watch the lights dim. You can do it anywhere, of course, from any street. But that's one of the places that's known for being a nice viewing place to do it and sort of raise a toast to your friend, Mare and Maisie. So I really did love her in Passion. She's a lovely actress, and it's a sad to see her go, but I'm glad she was public about what she was fighting, ovarian cancer, so that more women can be aware of it and be prepared to fight it. And I'm glad they are dimming the lights for her.
Well, and it should be noted, Sardi's is, it's in the 40s. I think it's 43rd.
It's in the theater district.
44th Street. And it overlooks a couple of theaters. So that is a good place to view it, actually. But that wraps up this week's episode of Showbiz Sandbox, and I'd like to thank once again Anne Thompson from IndieWire for joining us to discuss the Telluride and Toronto Film Festivals and, of course, the Emmy Awards. I will place links to all of her work in our show notes, which can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you will find ways to subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. Is where we can be found. And if you can't find us, please do write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, or call us 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. And if you can find us, by the way, rate and review the show. It does help us out when you do. And we do love to hear from you. So call us, write to us, follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. We're on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. You can like us there. Again, all of this information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's show. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's atlantawasrobbed.com.
Ah, the TV show Atlanta.
That's right.
Which did not win Best Comedy Series last night at the Emmys.
Nope.
Okay, but you know what? You can probably read about that over at michaelgiltz.com, where all of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry is aggregated. Of course, you should always check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, or at least hopefully until next week, play nice.
If time were money, we'd be broke. Good night, everybody.
What is that from?
It's actually from a song by Shaky Ghost. Shaky Graves, I mean. Shaky Graves is really good. A new album came out, and that was a line in there. If time was money, I've just gone broke. I thought, I like that.
That's
okay. It's also a very good album.
A good turn of phrase, and I'm surprised it's not something Bob Dylan didn't write. You could hear him writing that.
Absolutely.
Very good.